2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome to Inside Sources. Today you've got me, Leah Murray, and my good friend Taylor Morgan.
Hi there.
Sitting in for Boyd Matheson, and we will try to be as good as Boyd is.
We might be slightly more rowdy.
Yes, I think we always are. So I just want you all to know that we are waiting for a live press conference about the fact that former President Donald Trump's indictment was unsealed. Okay, so what we're going to do is go right to that press conference right now. Jack Smith right now.
Voted by a grand jury of citizens in the Southern District of Florida. And I invite everyone to read it in full to understand the scope and the gravity of the crimes charged. The men and women of the United States intelligence community and our armed forces dedicate their lives to protecting our nation and its people. Our laws that protect national defense information are critical to the safety and security of the United States, and they must be enforced. Violations of those laws put our country at risk. Adherence to the rule of law is a bedrock principle the Department of Justice, and our nation's commitment to the rule of law sets an example for the world. We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone. Applying those laws, collecting facts, that's what determines the outcome of an investigation. Nothing more and nothing less. The prosecutors in my office are among the most talented and experienced in the Department of Justice. They have investigated this case hewing to the highest ethical standards, and they will continue to do so as this case proceeds. It's very important for me to note that the defendants in this case must be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. To that end, my office will seek a speedy trial in this matter, consistent with the public interest and the rights of the accused. We very much look forward to presenting our case to a jury of citizens in the Southern District of Florida. In conclusion, I would like to thank the dedicated public servants of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, with whom my office is conducting this investigation, and who work tirelessly every day upholding the rule of law in our country. I'm deeply proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with them. Thank you very much.
Okay, Taylor, we just watched that. What are your takeaways?
Well, no questions were fielded. A brief statement was made by Special Counsel Smith remarking on the Trump indictment. I expected a lot more information, Leah. Certainly, we all have questions. I'm not sure why he left the stage there without fielding any questions. Leah, is it just me or was that a little awkward?
I also felt like it was short and he was saying, we did our job, so be nice to us. I mean, like a little bit of felt like, right?
It was a huge disclaimer almost, a huge like, hey, we worked really hard. Everybody's really great. Everybody's really sharp. You know, we're just the best. We did a good thing here and bye-bye.
Yeah.
So
we've got Amy Kobabe in the studio. She's been tracking, and my goodness, she has read the entire indictment. So I feel like she's the expert on what's going on. Can you talk to us about what you're seeing in that document?
Far from the expert, but there are a lot of takeaways from this that is new information. We were expecting several charges. We have now over 30 counts. And I just wanted to read some of the information that was in these documents. We didn't know. We knew classified. We'd heard that word before. But This is the information that is listed as classified defense and weapons capabilities of both United States and foreign countries, United States nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. So when we talk about top secret, these are really from briefings that the president had with top security and defense people that we're talking about these very sensitive materials. And then it also goes through some of the information that was just discussed between the president and his staffers on even the location of these documents. It goes through and says that it was some of the documents were just stored in a ballroom at the Mar-a-Lago estate where events were being held. And so you also have discussion of a hallway kind of storage room where they kept the door open often, and you had dozens of boxes there. At one point, a text message was sent to the president from a staffer showing that some of the wind had kind of disturbed these boxes and documents had just scattered across the floor. And they have this showing that these were top secret and anyone could have just walked in and grabbed a handful of documents, you know, nuclear capabilities and walked away.
Oh, Amy, so interesting. Stay with us, Amy, and keep reading through that indictment. There is so much there. We're going to be bringing you on to give us some updates. Right now, we want to bring on John Huber, who is a former federal prosecutor, former U.S. attorney for Utah. John is with us now here on KSL Inside Sources. John, how are you reacting to this indictment?
Well, I think I'm reacting like many Americans, which causes us great trepidation, causes us great anxiety. We've never had this experience before as Americans, so we're all riveted by it. This indictment that now is, public, this is, you know, you talk about the devil is in the details. There are a lot of details, well over 40 pages of you know, line by line, point by point. Obviously, a lot of work has gone into this. And this is a big charges leveled against the former president.
So, John, I don't know if you were watching the press conference like we were watching, but we were both stunned that he didn't talk more. So we were.
Yeah.
Did you have a takeaway
that
from
why
that was
abrupt.
So short?
Yeah. What was your? How did you feel about that, John?
Well, look, you're talking. He's not the attorney general. He's a special prosecutor. His career thus far has been really, you know, behind the scenes. He hasn't been a U.S. attorney before where he's responsible to talk to the public. So I think, A, it's a fish out of water, and then, B, you have literally the whole world, if not galaxy, watching. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of pressure on one person, and so I'm not too surprised that it was very brief.
Yeah.
So, John, I'm also wondering, too, another development that happened today was that the former president's lawyers quit. Two of them stepped down. Can you speak to us about that at all and why that would be happening?
I don't know. You know, we like to speculate, but none of us really know what's going on there. It's not unusual for legal teams to shift. I'm not sure if it's related to actually seeing what the charges were and whether they may have a conflict of interest or maybe witnesses themselves to some of the allegations. That may be part of it. Or, you know, we know the president, the former president, is one who turns over people a lot. So I don't know if that's the president, the former president was involved in that decision or not.
Yeah. John, how, in your assessment, how is this situation with Donald Trump, with the documents that he had, how is this different and why now has a grand jury in Southern Florida indicted Donald Trump when we know that both President Biden, former Vice President Mike Pence, also had some classified documents? How is this situation so different?
Yeah, you can go back decades and on either side of the political spectrum see big names who have been entwined with headlines relating to mishandling or classified information. The names you mentioned, abbreviated list, Biden, Comey, Clinton, Pence. I mean, you can go to General Petraeus. The list is quite long, but it is apples and oranges. And that's why I say the devil is in the details, and there's a lot of details here. I was personally involved in vetting and reviewing the case involving Hillary Clinton during her time as Secretary of State. apples and oranges. I think one distinction that we're seeing as we start to really look and understand the indictment is that obstruction type conduct, that those allegations, those may be a difference that is significant in whether the Department of Justice decided to bring it or not. So as we understand those allegations better, and you know, obstruction, conspiracy to obstruct, a false statement, which is the code, the U.S. code's way of saying lying to an agent or U.S. government representative. So that may be a distinction. The other thing to keep in mind is, look, when in the very early years of my prosecution career, as 27 years of public servant, very early years, I did speeding cases. And, you know, a common defense I'd hear out in the hallways or outside the traffic court was, well, I was going the same speed as everybody else. Everybody else was speeding. Why do I get a ticket? That's not where you focus as a charged criminal defendant. You focus on the evidence that is against you. It's never going to be a successful defense to say, well, point my finger at everybody else. That might be in the court of public opinion, something that you want to talk about a lot. But in the court, the federal court of Miami, Florida, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida, it's not going to get you anywhere. You've got to really confront the evidence that's against you as an individual.
Okay, John, so you just talked about the court of public opinion, which to me says political. And I think the former president saying this is a witch hunt, this is all political. Do you think politics are playing a factor here? And to what extent are they or not?
Look, I hope not. I served for pretty much two decades in the Department of Justice. Most of those years as a civil servant merit employee, six of those years as a political appointee by presidents of two administrations, two different parties. I served attorneys general of two different parties and was appointed to leadership roles by those. The Department of Justice takes their role seriously. But on the other hand, you have to live up to the charges you bring. These are some of the most serious charges you can bring. And then when you add that it's the former president of the United States, unprecedented, historical to our country,
Yeah. You've
really got to have it right, because everyone's watching and we place a lot of faith in those systems. To prove beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury appears is a very steep hill to climb in a regular case, let alone a case of this magnitude.
We are speaking with John Huber, former federal prosecutor, former U.S. attorney for Utah. Listeners, this is a very special edition of Inside Sources Now. We are reacting in real time, live to breaking news out of Southern Florida about a new 38-count federal indictment that has been unsealed by the Department of Justice against former President Donald J. Trump regarding classified materials kept at Mar-a-Lago. So we're reacting and responding in real time. John, I want to ask you about the special prosecutor made it a point to say that he will pursue a speedy trial in this case. Jack Smith is the special counsel. He's the one who had the press conference there, who essentially talked about the good work, did not take questions, left after a few seconds. It was the shortest press conference I've ever seen, which means we don't have a lot to go with from the special counsel here. But he did say he will pursue a speedy trial. What does that mean, most likely, vis-a-vis the Republican presidential primary?
Well, the government's right to a speedy trial is something, but it is secondary to the individual's right. This is guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States, our founding document, that you get a fair and speedy public trial. And in the federal system, that means 70 days. So 10 weeks from the day he shows up in court on Tuesday, that is the former president and his co-defendant, the government is mandated to try that case within 70 days, unless the parties, and usually it's the charged person who holds that card. If the charged person decides, well, hold on a second, for a fair trial, I need some more time to prepare. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the government once says we want to try this in 70 days. That's well and good, but they have had all of the evidence in their pocket. But starting Tuesday, if not earlier, they'll be providing their entire prosecution file that's required by law to give to former president and this co-defendant And they should have a fair amount of time to see what the evidence is against them in great detail, you know, the files and folders and electronic evidence that will be provided to them to help prepare their defense. If they decide they want a longer time to get a fair trial, the judge will probably extend this out beyond 70 days.
All right, John Huber, former federal prosecutor, former U.S. attorney for Utah. I thank you so much for being with us and helping us kind of figure all this out.
Yeah, appreciate you, John. Thank you for the updates.
Good talking with you.
All right, so we're going to go to a break, and we'll have more on what's going on when you come back. Stay with us.
Stay with us.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at KSLPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Today you are with me, Taylor Morgan, and my co-host, Leah Murray, Dr. Professor Leah Murray, in the political science department at Weber State University. I run a local political consulting lobbying shop called Morgan May Public Affairs. That's who we are. We want to continue talking about the indictment that was just unsealed by the Department of Justice, a 38-count indictment indicting former President Donald J. Trump and his associate Walt Nauta. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Walt Nauta were both charged in this 38-count indictment. A few minutes ago in the last segment, we went live to Florida for a press conference with Jack Smith, special counsel, who was handling essentially this grand jury decision and announced it and then left abruptly, not taking any questions. So we're still kind of, I think, Leah, just kind of getting our feet under us. We are reacting to that. We had John Huber, a wonderful former federal prosecutor and U.S. attorney for Utah, on. We're going to hopefully be bringing on KSL legal analyst Greg Skordis. We have here with us in studio the intrepid Amy Kobabe, who has been digging through every page of this indictment. When I first got to the studio, Leah, Amy waved this big, thick, chunk of paper at me.
My favorite was that she printed it.
She had printed it out, right?
I was, I was reading it.
A hard copy.
Yeah.
So, Amy, what can you tell us? What have you found that has really caught your interest to start with?
Well, there's a lot in here that really just spells out that Donald Trump had these documents, was actively looking at them, and there were discussions of these documents. And as we look at the difference between him and this case and other people who've worked in the White House, right? We have former president or former vice president and our current president, President Biden, right now, that have dealt with similar things. And so when we look at that, the difference that I see is that you have someone who has said they didn't know and they weren't aware, and when they found it, they turned it over. And then in this case, it really is the DOJ just trying to spell out exactly how much the president was aware of these documents. Him and his valet were aware, were moving them actively, and were discussing them with other staffers who did not have any sort of security clearance and had access to these, and were touching them frequently.
Right. Yep. So, Amy, it's like 31 counts related to withholding national defense information, 5 counts related to concealing the possession of those documents. So that, I think, speaks a little bit to the obstruction. And then 2 counts of false statements, because former President Trump and his aide actually lied about where boxes were or that they had given them. I'm wondering, because I know you've read all the pages, at the end, are they talking about possible penalties and what we're talking about?
So under each of these accounts, you have maximum term imprisonment laid out of each single count. So 1 through 31, maximum term imprisonment, 10 years. For the conspiracy to obstruct justice, 20 years maximum term possible. Withholding a document or record, 20 years. And it goes like that. The only small, quote unquote small imprisonment time would be the scheme to conceal and count 37 false statements. Both of those carry possible max time of 5 years. And so we've seen this in other criminal cases where sometimes they combine these. And again, this is max. So that's not a guarantee. And this all has to play out in court still. But having those numbers there really does tell you the seriousness of these charges and these alleged crimes. These are national security secrets that no one wants played around with.
And I think what is so significant here is that not only do we know and have evidence that he had these classified confidential documents relating to national security and so on in his possession, but more importantly, he knew what he had, and he willfully and intentionally tried to conceal possession of these documents and obstructed justice, in a sense. That to me is significant. And earlier in the previous segment, I asked the question, what makes this so different than the cases involving President Biden and documents and former President Vice President Mike Pence? I think this is one of the key differences. It is the willful, the knowledge of what the documents were, and then the intent to conceal and obstruct the investigation here. I think that is significant.
Right. So, Amy Kobe, stay on the case and come back in and tell us if anything big is happening. Thank you so much.
Dig through there, Amy. Find the next great thing for us, please.
All right. So, listeners, stay with us. After this break, we will have KSL's own legal analyst, Greg Skordas.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to an expanded Inside Sources. Today you are with Taylor Morgan and Leah Murray. We are filling in for Boyd Matheson. And Leah, we are still responding to the indictment that was just unsealed by the Department of Justice, indicting former President Donald Trump with numerous counts, up to 38 counts, including obstruction of justice. There is still a lot we don't know, Leah. We are learning more about this. We had the live press conference at the beginning of the show with special counsel Jack Smith from Southern Florida. This is a grand jury decision to indict Donald Trump in Florida. There is a lot here, Leah, a lot of questions. You and I are still reading through the indictment, getting a handle on this. We have joining the show to help us understand the indictment, Greg Skordas, KSL news analyst and overall just amazing guy. Greg, welcome to the show. And how are you reacting to the indictment?
Wow, Taylor, it's much, much bigger and broader than we thought. People were talking yesterday as though it was a seven-count indictment. And in fact, there are seven different types of charges, but one of the charges alone has 31 counts. So there are seven different crimes charged, but there are actually 38 counts. It's pretty broad. They've done a ton of work here, and this is about as open of an indictment as you can imagine. A lot of them are just, you're charged with this crime, you're charged with this crime. This one says, based on these facts, and then it goes through almost 49 pages of facts. Then they say what the crimes are. So it's what we call a speaking indictment. It tells you what the allegations are, and it tells you what the underlying charges are.
Right. So, Greg, I was reading, not as well as you, I'm sure, the indictment, and it seems like here's the things that are happening, right? Like there are documents where they're not supposed to be. But then they also seem to be saying, here is the former president saying he would respect classified information. Can you speak us to, is that what you mean when you say it's a speaking indictment? Are they building a case of he knew what he was doing was wrong and he had publicly said that he would abide by these rules? Like, is that why those pieces are in that indictment?
Yes, exactly. So they're adding a lot of information because I think part of the problem we have here is that there are other individuals, including the current president, who had documents, and they're trying to separate Trump a little bit and say, look, we're bringing this case because he went out of his way to conceal this. He lied to agents about this. He knew that these were classified. He bragged about it. He boasted about it. He talked about it. So there's no there's no way that he's going to claim ignorance here. And that's why they went through a lot of his statements and his comments to individuals. Seems like a lot of people are tape recording him when they talk to him. Yeah. But he's sure made a lot of comments that are going to be real problematic for him if this goes to trial.
Yeah. I'm looking at some of the images now that we are seeing live on television news. These images are also included in the indictment
right.
that is
pictures
publicly
of it.
Available,
yeah.
Photos. We're seeing stacks of banker's boxes, is what they call them, document boxes everywhere on the stage, in the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, in a bathroom, and in other places. A lot of documents. I can understand why a president, when they leave office, would have a lot of documents that they would take with them. We know, though, according to the indictment, that Donald Trump knew specifically which classified, which national security documents he had and was in possession of, and intentionally obstructed justice. That, again, that to me is the most significant thing in this indictment, is that there's evidence that he knew what he had. He tried to conceal what he had, and he obstructed justice in the investigation related to those documents. Greg, am I overstepping there? Do you think that's fair?
No. I think you said it just right, and I think that's the same thing Leah was saying, that it's not just he had possession of classified documents, but that he knew he had possession of classified documents, and he had them in places where he was having parties, where he had guests over, where he had people. And they're sort of laying around. I mean, it's not like he had them in some sealed box or safe or something, at least according to this indictment. And, of course, he's presumed innocent. But they really go through a lot of information to show not only that he knew that they were classified, but that he knew he shouldn't have them, and that he sort of was brazen about it.
Yeah, and his valet, he instructed his valet to relocate those specific documents. This is Walt Nauta, who is also charged in this indictment. He's included along with former President Donald Trump in the indictment.
So, Greg, talk to me about another development that happened today. I think two of the former president's lawyers actually stepped down. Can you talk to us about what does that do to the case, right? Does the president need to get some new lawyers? Like, how does that work? And why maybe they would have stepped down?
I think to start with the last question, Leah, I believe one of the lawyers has to step down because he testified under oath that all of the documents had been turned over. And arguably, he was relying on his client when he said that. But that was not true. That was absolutely not true. If you look at these boxes that Taylor was just talking about, they didn't turn over hardly anything. So this lawyer's in a little bit of a jam, and he's probably wanting to separate himself from his client, the former president, as much as possible. And certainly Donald Trump has the resources to hire other lawyers, but the ones that have been working with him so far are tainted. They're compromised. And ethically, they can no longer continue to represent him because they made false statements.
Yeah. I think this is so interesting, too. We learned from the indictment that Donald Trump can be convicted just for having possession in an unauthorized location of these documents. A conviction does not require any evidence of any desire or intent to disseminate classified information. Just having possession and having that possession knowingly and willfully, that is enough for a conviction. Again, we're presuming innocence. The grand jury, we know, has voted to indict former President Trump, so they clearly see evidence that is worth taking to trial. Greg, as an attorney, what is Donald Trump's best defense? We have, just 30 seconds or so. You're a defense attorney. If you were advising Donald Trump, what would you tell him to do?
I would tell him to shut up. I mean, he's his own worst enemy. And I'm sorry to say that, but he's just out there boasting, and he's taking the typical approach that he takes, which is the best defense is a good offense, and he's not helping himself. If I was his attorney, I would say, sit back, let me do my job, and let's try to win this case without you burying us in the press.
All right, Greg Skordas, KSL's legal analyst, thank you so much for joining us today.
Love it, Greg. Thank you.
All right. After this, we're going to have a conversation about the 2024 presidential election And I don't even know.
It's getting spicier.
Yeah, it's going to get spicier. Come back after the break.
Inside Sources, an inside look at 2024 presidential politics.
All right, Taylor. Welcome back, everybody. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and my good friend, Taylor. We are chatting about all things political, and the first hour has been amazing, and I think possibly giantly disruptive
of
any conversation we were planning on having in the next
Toss
9 minutes.
Toss it all out the window, Leah.
Maybe. So it's been a busy week for presidential politics, and if you've been following KSL, which I know you all have been, a number of candidates are announcing their bids. We've got Chris Christie, former governor of New Jersey.
Who?
North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum.
Who?
They're announcing. Former Vice President Mike Pence.
Who?
Announcing. Taylor. All these people running for Republican nomination. I imagine you're getting emails from all of them.
Getting a lot of emails. And in fact, I just pulled up an email I just received from former President Donald Trump using this indictment, the quote-unquote witch hunt, in a very clever fundraising ask at different tiers of donations tied to the indictment charges. Very, very crafty campaign fundraising move by the Trump team.
Like within an hour of us listening to and the thing, indictment being unsealed.
Right, and I think, look, we want to talk about the Republican race for the presidential nomination in 2024. Obviously, the breaking news that we have been covering so far here on Inside Sources, the unsealing of the DOJ indictment against former President Trump, that is changing everything. I think it is a bombshell. It's hugely significant. Leah, a couple candidates have reacted already. Republican presidential candidates have weighed in. What have they said so far?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is kind of interesting. As you kind of, how do you navigate how close you're going to be with former President Trump, who is very popular, I think, with a base of the Republican voters.
Well, he's leading. He is way ahead.
Right. Yeah. So you've got to be careful on how you attack him, that you don't alienate people who want to vote for him. But Chris Christie, who announced this week, basically said if Trump committed a crime and there is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, then he must be charged. So, and that Trump's legal woes are self-inflicted wounds. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson releasing a statement that Donald Trump's actions, from his willful disregard for the Constitution to his disrespect for the rule of law, should not define our nation or the Republican Party. So those two are kind of like leading into it. Does that make sense? Like, this is not okay what's happening. Other people are not as much, right? So South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis saying the weaponization of federal law enforcement represents a mortal threat to a free society, saying not that it's okay, like they're not defending the former president, but why are we not also investigating Hillary Clinton, or Hunter Biden at the same time, right? So I'm not going to attack the former president. I'm able to comment that this is probably not great behavior, but I'm able to, you know, throw some side eye, if you will, at the uneven application of justice.
Yeah. And I think we will continue to see similar responses. Senator Mitt Romney from Utah has already reacted, essentially defending the indictment or pointing out the gravity of the charges in the indictment. I think that's what we would have expected. A lot more to come, I'm sure, Leah, in the coming days and weeks. I think.
But pause just real quick right there. Senator Romney, right, he's got a lot more room, right? He voted to impeach.
Absolutely.
Right, to indict on
the impeachment. No one is surprised by Mitt Romney criticizing
President.
Right, so he's got
some space. Yeah. I think other Republicans are trying to figure out how much legs, right, how many legs, sorry, like how much traction this is going to have.
Yeah.
And like you said off the air, Taylor, if he is convicted.
Yes.
What happens?
He is constitutionally ineligible to hold the office of president of the United States. That's significant because sentences are significant. Amy Kobabe in the last segment walked us through some of the potential maximum sentences tied to these charges. I think the single most impactful outcome would be if he's convicted on any of these charges. Leah, he's constitutionally not able to be president. That's
all right,
huge.
So now let's just talk that politics real quick for a second. So what does that mean for the Republican nominating cycle, right? Like, do the voters who are his voters disappear and now you're trying to mobilize them? I mean, who rises to the top?
So
You've got like a few seconds.
Criminal charges and an indictment are nothing new for former President Donald Trump. Now, I'm not dismissing the gravity of the charges in this indictment. I do think it is different and something new. However, here we are again, and everyone in the press today is talking about former President Trump, and we will continue to talk about him.
Yeah.
We have been and we will. This is what Donald Trump does so well, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish between him creating press coverage or him falling into press coverage by bad choices. It's hard to know, Leah, but the fact is that Donald Trump is the top story in America, if not the world, today. He has been for the last few months, and he is likely going to be the top story for the unforeseeable future.
All right, well, let's take a moment and let's listen to another person. So we'll give someone else some airtime in the Republican
Party. Sure, let's do that. Yeah.
So let's listen to North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum announcing he's running.
We need a leader who's experienced firsthand that we win as a country when our innovators and entrepreneurs can soar and when every single person can grow and thrive. To unlock the best of America, we need a leader who's clearly focused on three things: economy, energy, and national security. And that is why today I'm officially announcing I'm running for the President of the United States of America.
Doug's putting me to sleep with his talking points, Leah.
I was wondering, would you be sending him money the way
I didn't
you
hear
might
anything
have?
Interesting okay. or compelling. Seems like a nice guy. North Dakota's okay. But he, again, kind of a nothing there. I respect him, appreciate his service, but yeah, he's not going anywhere. Someone else who is irrelevant, perhaps a blast from the past here,
Taylor.
Leah, who has nothing better to do, is former Governor Chris Christie. Let's listen to what he said earlier this week.
And I thought I could help to make him a better candidate and a better president if he won. And I didn't want Hillary Clinton to be president. And that's why I ran in the first place. Turned out I was wrong. I couldn't make him a better candidate and I couldn't make him a better president. And he disappointed me and he disappointed a lot of people in my party and a lot of people in this country by the way he performed. And for me, the breaking point was election night 2020 when he's out there at 2:30 in the morning claiming the election was stolen when I knew he had no evidence to prove that. And when you undercut democracy in that way, you have forfeited the trust, in my view, to hold that office that he's now trying to regain.
Yeah, so a little bit Chris Christie, I think, in my mind, similar to our Senator Romney in that he's been very outspoken critic.
Lately.
Right. Yeah, but that's okay. So when the indictment comes down, we talked about earlier, he's criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I do worry a little bit about, right, Taylor, is Chris Christie's like, I want to run so I can attack former President Trump. And then I just think, ugh. You know, the pugnaciousness of what the next 18 months might look like, if that's what he's going for, makes me a little sick to my stomach.
Yeah, as a Republican, I'm looking for someone to talk about something else other than Donald Trump. Let's move forward. Let's move past it. Chris Christie, I mean, the guy has no right to be sanctimonious and judge anyone else. He's got his own issues. And Chris Christie, thanks for your services, Governor, but you're polling at 1%. Like, just please retire and hang out with your family and do something worthwhile.
All right. So let's listen to – so on the other side of the aisle, President Biden really isn't campaigning. And I think I have some thoughts about why he's not campaigning. But he does get news because he's president, right? So we talk about he's always going to get covered. And yesterday he met with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, and they're chatting about their shared goals for the future.
It outlines how we can enhance our cooperation to accelerate the clean energy transition that must take place and is taking place, lead the development of emerging technologies that are going to shape so much of our future, and protect technologies critical to our national security. And a key piece of that is working together to strengthen our critical mineral supply chains and to make them more resilient so we're not dependent on any one country to meet our goals.
And I thought North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum was boring.
Taylor, I gave that to you totally. I knew you were going to say.
Listeners, stick around. Coming up next in the next hour of Inside Sources, we're going to kick off the show in that hour with Greg Hughes, who is running for the 2nd Congressional District for the nomination in the Republican Party. It'll be a great convo. Stay with us.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. You are with Taylor Morgan and Leah Murray. Today we are filling in for Boyd Matheson. We are now beginning the second hour of the newly expanded Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Leah, the first hour flew by. It was a whirlwind.
It was intense.
We were reacting live in real time to the press conference regarding the indictment of former President Donald Trump, an indictment of President Trump and an associate. A lot to get into there. Leah, we're going to pivot now and talk about, I think, the top local story, which is the coming resignation of Congressman Chris Stewart in Utah.
Who is stepping down September 15th.
He is stepping down in September, citing concerns about his family's health, his wife's health. Certainly wish her well.
Right.
Thank Representative Stewart for his service. Wish the entire family well. It's sad to hear that he's leaving service for that reason, but we certainly wish him well. We know that Governor Spencer Cox received his resignation letter, so it's official. That kicked off the governor calling a special session of the legislature to make some adjustments to the timeline of Utah's special election process. And the candidate declaration period just started.
Right, I was going to say, what I thought was super interesting is it kicked off the filing
period
for people to make it official they were running. So I think when Representative Stewart said he was stepping down, before it was official, some people were talking.
Yes.
And there's been lots of rumors. But now we have official lists, right?
We have an official list. The declaration period for candidates opened yesterday. The state elections office has been tweeting out updates about who has filed.
Right.
A number of candidates have already filed. We have with us now joining Inside Sources. Leah, I don't know if you know this, but this gentleman represented me in the Utah State House of Representatives.
Did he do a good job?
He is my favorite.
He's your favorite.
Former Speaker of the House, Greg Hughes. Former Speaker Greg Hughes, welcome to the show. You have filed to run for this office. Talk to us. Why do you want to run? What are you doing? What do you hope to accomplish serving the 2nd District?
First, I want to say, Leah, he says that to every former speaker.
No. There's not that many of them, Leah. So you know,
he's just tricking me. I know what he's doing. So, thanks for having me on, Leah and Taylor. Look, this is what. When did the Representative Chris Stewart or Congressman Chris Stewart announce this? 10 days ago. I mean, it feels like maybe 10 months ago in terms of how much discussion and everything else. I have to tell you that no one that I know saw this coming. And as we looked at this race and looked at, the 2nd congressional district, it's such a unique district. It's Southern Utah, which isn't all rural. I mean, I don't know that you can call Washington County rural anymore with all their growth. But you have Southern Utah, you have rural Utah. It comes up the west side of the state and off Wasatch counties, goes into Tooele, and then it has a portion of Salt Lake County and Davis County. I think the reason that there's a couple reasons why I decided to throw my hat in the ring and have a go at this. In the 2020 race, that I can talk about it now, I'm over it. I didn't win for governor. It didn't happen for me. But we did have a lot of success. We won 10 counties. 7 of those counties are in the 2nd congressional district. Mm. And I feel like the voters, they understood me as a candidate. I understand them. I understand those issues. There are also issues, Leah and Taylor, that I worked on when I was a member of the House, even Speaker of the House. We worked on lands issues. We worked on water issues, infrastructure, all the things that are unique maybe to off the Wasatch Front. But, of course, I've also worked on issues that touch Washington or Salt Lake County and Davis County.
Yeah.
Anyway, I look at the district and I feel like I'm an adopted kid from Southern Utah and rural Utah. And I also think I have the ability to make a compelling case as we go into the northern part of the state and into the Wasatch Front. So that makes sense. But why I'm really doing this is it feels like I'm enlisting in the military more than filing for office. I am not under any illusion that this is going to be a blast, that this is fun. What it is it's a, I'm grateful for the country I've lived in and the opportunities I've had. I'm worried. I got kids. I'm worried about the future.
Yeah.
And what I'm watching in Washington is fundamentally unsustainable. So I have a worry for our country. And so I've decided to throw my hat in the ring and do my bit. I'm not ready to give up the ship. If I can help, if my legislative experience getting, moving the needle, if I can be a positive impact, I think I need to at least try.
Yeah, so
that's why I'm doing it.
A couple points I want to make. First, I recall very vividly during your gubernatorial campaign in Southern Utah. I drive a lot. I spend a lot of time in Southern Utah driving to Lake Powell or going canyoneering in Zion or out and about. I saw more Greg Hughes campaign signs than anyone else down in Southern Utah. I think that was interesting. My second point is that you're a boxer. You are, how do I say this? Often in politics, there's this notion that we send our fighters back to D.C. to do the dirty work and slug it out in Congress. I think that, just from a personal note, knowing you, I think you're a nice fit for that. So I think that's interesting. Nobody wants to get in a fight with Greg Hughes, right? So a couple reactions from me that are interesting. Yeah. Leah, you had a thought.
Yeah. So, Greg, I'm wondering, and I love how you said, I love what you just said, and maybe it's the answer, that if you have something to offer, you're going to do it to serve, you know, our country and our community. But I've been watching what's happening in the House this week. And I'm just, you know, are you sure this is the best choice?
No,
I mean,
It's a good question. So what I think you're watching is, I've gone back to Washington to testify when I was a leader in the state legislature, and they don't have committee hearings. They're not in their chamber debating bills unless it's a debt ceiling crisis. You don't see the legislative body working the way you'll see it in every state in this country. The separate and equal powers of the legislative branch, that's where the heavy lifting is supposed to happen. Now, as a freshman, you can't walk in there and wag your finger at everyone, but it is an effort of math. It is a game of addition. You have to have numbers. You can't get anything out of a committee without enough votes. You can't get anything off of the floor. So what that the legislature has to do is you cannot get anything done by reducing and pulling back and refusing to work. And so I'm watching Washington, D.C. I'm watching Congress right now, and I think that there needs to be, and what I would want to do is really talk about how are we going to not let executive orders ruin our lives because presidents can do executive orders if the legislative branch isn't going to legislate. Hmm. What about the judicial branch and how much strength it has? If the legislative branch is not fulfilling its role and there's a vacuum there, it will get filled. And I am telling you, what is happening in Washington, D.C. is unsustainable, and it is hitting us, every family, with inflation. And that inflation, it's not a number. It's your groceries. It's your gas. It's how you get to work. It's your paycheck shrinking.
Yeah.
There is so much hitting us that I it's not hyperbole. I don't see it as sustainable and the trajectory we're going in. So, I'm going to speak up. I know that's a long answer. If that
no,
was an
Greg,
elevator
that's
pitch.
Yeah,
that's
no,
that's great.
Building,
we have just about a minute left or so, Greg, and I have to ask you. Your campaign announced that you will be pursuing nomination via the Republican convention path, and I know that you and I have not always agreed on SB 54. I recall some very intense conversations in the lobby at church about this, and we've always been able to talk about it, and I respect that. Tell us quickly, why did you make the choice to go convention only, especially knowing that only one candidate can emerge from convention?
It's a high risk. Look, and I understand that. But I don't like making decisions out of fear, first off. But Taylor, what the convention represents to me and the delegates that get elected from their respective neighborhoods is the highest information election cycle we're going to get. I only have 2 weeks, so I'm a little bit behind the curve in terms of being able to meet with every delegate. But if I had the chance to be face-to-face or have a discussion or take any question from a voter, I would do that all day. It is the election cycle I am most comfortable in, because then you're not misrepresented. You're not misunderstood. You have that shot to make your case and earn someone's support. I love that. I absolutely love it. And so to hedge your bet, and this is how I feel about it, if I were to go get signatures, my fear is that delegates lose that ability to make those decisions, because what you're saying to them is, I really would love your support, but at the end of the day, I found a way to get in that primary, and to continue on. And that's just not who I am.
Look, it's
in law. It's what it is. We'll have signature gatherers in the race, and that's great.
Okay.
I'll take my chances with delegates.
Yeah. Thank you for the straight up answer, Greg. Appreciate you coming on KSL Inside Sources. We look forward to watching you throughout the special election. Best of luck to you. And thanks again. Leah.
Yep, thanks for having me on.
You bet, Greg. Leah, the special election to fill Chris Stewart's vacancy is also having a significant impact on municipal elections in Utah. We are in a municipal election year, odd years. And the legislature and governor are set to most likely tie the special election timetable to the municipal races, which throws everything out the window city candidates. So coming up next on Inside Sources, we will have a current candidate that is running to be mayor of Ogden. We'll have her on to talk about how this is impacting her race. Stay with us, listeners.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Today, you don't have Boyd Matheson. You have me, Leah Murray, and my good friend, Taylor Morgan.
Hopefully, Boyd is somewhere warm and sunny
and not worried about what we just did to
vacationing.
His show.
Yeah, right? Boyd, we'll clean up in here and turn the lights off when we're done.
That's right, Boyd. When you come back, it'll be ready. So we have got with us Angel Castillo, who is a planning commissioner in the city of Ogden.
Former
planning commissioner. Thank you so much. I'm sorry.
No
I'm reading that wrong. Angel, tell us who you are. Tell us why you're running. Give us all the information.
My name is Angel Castillo. I live in Ogden, and I care deeply about Ogden. I am running because there are some challenges that we have within our administration with regards to growth, planning, housing. And as a former planning commissioner, I see the importance of making sure that while growth is inevitable, that it's thoughtful, it's sustainable, and it has a positive economic impact. I am running to make sure that there is equity and access for small businesses and a pathway to home ownership.
All right.
Yeah. Angel, why run to be mayor of Ogden? This is something that, I always ask candidates because it is so hard to run.
What is wrong with
for
you?
Public
That's
Ogden.
What Taylor does.
It is brutal.
You have to raise
a lot
of money. You got to ask your friends and family to give you money, which is always uncomfortable. You go knock on strangers' doors. You subject yourself to all kinds of criticism in the public space. What really is prompting you to do this and why and how will you make a difference?
Well, I originally, when I moved here, I ran for mayor in 2019 and I had no intention of running. I was originally supporting another candidate. And as I am a marketing consultant, they asked me to make sure I could help them with messaging and do some op-ed research. And that person ended up not running. And once I'd done a couple of months of research, I couldn't unsee what I saw. And once I knew what I knew, and the fact that we were not being adequately represented as taxpayers, the city is competing with private business as a developer, I had to run. You know, and believe me, nobody was more surprised to get out of primary than I was. Because at the time of election, I'd only lived here for a year and 9 months. Well, I was a planning commissioner 30 days after moving here because I understand how important planning is.
Right.
I had no intention of running. And when I ran, all of the things that were important to me were important to other people. And losing by 8 points is kind of miraculous, considering I'd only been here for a year and 9 months at time of election. And, you know, I called the housing crisis 2 years before Kempsey Gardner wrote their paper, because I know that it's so important. It is so important, especially for our working class economy, our teachers, our fire, our police, our folks that work at our coffee shops and restaurants, that they have access and a pathway to home ownership. And I don't think that we're doing enough as a city with the property that we own to be leading. And I have a bunch of innovative ideas that are being utilized successfully in other states. And I would like Ogden to lead in that for Utah.
Yeah. Municipal government really is where the rubber meets the road when it comes to government. Leah, I know you're a political science professor. You've probably been to a few city council meetings in your time.
They're the most fun.
They really are. And then you throw in the public comment period.
The open mic night.
It always gets interesting. Mm-hmm. There is so much work that is done at the municipal level. It is, again, where really policy happens that impacts Utahns every day. Mm-hmm. You do have some competitors in this race. Mm-hmm. There are a few candidates running to be mayor. My understanding is that you're a bit unique in the field. Because if you were to be elected, you would be the very first woman to be mayor of Ogden, and also the very first Latina.
That is correct.
To be, why do you think? Again, not that we totally buy in, or I don't always buy in on identity politics. I think there is something interesting there. But just who you are, what would that mean for Ogden City?
Well, representation matters, right? You can't be what you can't see. And I've done some work helping assemble and facilitate some listening sessions for Dr. Susan R. Madsen, who is the leading expert on disparity gaps for women in the state of Utah. And women don't run unless they're asked multiple times. Yeah. Women will not apply for a job unless they're, and I'm not exactly sure on the data, but it's in the high 90s, if they don't have almost everything, whereas men will only apply for a job if they've, or will apply for a job if they've got 40%. And so it's important that while we are 50% of the population, that we have representation. It is important that in government, that it is representative of the folks that are in the district that you're running. And so I've had some, you'd mentioned earlier about why would you run?
Because yeah,
right. It is really, really hard. And running for office is simultaneously the best thing that you could ever do in your life, because it connects you to community in a way that you've never been connected before,
yeah.
And the worst thing.
Yeah.
And one of those best moments is when I have little girls come up to me and tell me that they didn't know that women could be mayors. They didn't know that women could be leaders, because it tends not to be on the heavy side of female representation. So
yeah, that is so important.
That's important.
Yeah. Well, speaking of running for office and campaigns being challenging, yours just got more challenging with the adjustments to the timeline, or potentially challenging. I guess I'm not putting those words in your mouth, but we know that Governor Cox has called for a special session. Mm-hmm. The legislature is going to make some adjustments to the municipal election timeline in order to accommodate a special election to fill the vacancy that will be left by Congressman Chris Stewart. As a candidate for mayor of Ogden, this is your cycle, right? This is the municipal cycle.
Yep.
How is that special election going to impact your race?
Well, it's going to impact everybody in a big way, and I am grateful I held off with pre-printing materials with primary and election date on it, because it's not going to impact me for that. But I understand it on three different levels, right? As someone who is concerned with making sure that government is efficient and that we're spending our money effectively, it's going to save us a lot of money do so. From the I'm a citizen and representation is important, to not have a seat with someone who can directly address your issues on a national level, it's imperative. I mean, just because we've done some work with Blake Moore and some of the work he's done with veterans, it's direct and it helps facilitate things. And if you were a Gold Star family or a veteran that was needing some intervention to move things along and you didn't have someone in that seat, yes, the Senate could probably cover it, but you know, nobody knows local like local.
Yeah.
And then as a marketing consultant, I do have some hesitation because we've worked so hard to train people that the first Tuesday in November is when we vote. So I would hope that there is going to be some investment on education and a promotion package to really make sure that people understand that this is what's happening.
Yeah.
Right. And I appreciate all of that. And I like how you just said, I'm so glad I didn't print the things with the dates, right? Like, I think that really matters. Angel, how else does it affect your campaign? I mean, do you feel like it changes when you talk to people, when you're doing canvassing? Like, has it changed any of that logistics for you? Or you're just like, I'm just adding 2 weeks to the work that I do?
Well, it has impacted it in the fact that it's going to cost more money.
Gotcha.
But it's not going to impact my outreach at all, because at this stage of the game, it's all hands on deck, all the people, all the time, talk to as many folks to understand what's important to them and how you can make sure that you are going to be the person trusted to carry that message.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps you have a little more time to get that message out and reach voters. The second district does not incorporate Ogden, per se. I think that we may potentially see an uptick in voter participation in municipal elections within the second district. That's interesting. And maybe even outside the second district.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the whole state, because all of us are going to be talking about the weirdness of it.
We're talking
might
elections.
Might counteract, what you said, and I think it's a fair point, that everyone is trained since the dawn of time, that the election is this day, this Tuesday in November.
Yeah.
But we'll be talking about it a lot, so hopefully. Mm-hmm.
I kind of love it, because we have been in the press. We've been talking so much about the Republican presidential nomination that happens next spring in 2024. And now we are talking Utah elections. We are talking municipal elections, I think, to a scale that we rarely discuss them. So I'm excited about that. And I hope that does improve participation, because these are really important elections.
So, Angel, we've got 10 seconds. Give us a website where people can check you out.
It is angel4ogden.com.
Number four?
It's both. Okay. You can spell it out, or you can type in the number four, angelforogden.com.
Angel Castillo, candidate for mayor of Ogden City. Thank you so much for being on Inside Sources. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
All right. And coming up after the break, we'll have a conversation with Weber County's clerk, Ricky Hatch.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. This is Taylor Morgan. I am joined by my co-pilot today, Leah Murray. We are filling in for Boyd Matheson. I presume Boyd is out on vacation somewhere beautiful, somewhere wonderful.
Having a good time.
He always goes to great places. I need to get his summer vacation itinerary, because Boyd goes to the best places.
You're going to just follow him around on his vacation,
might.
Taylor?
Yeah, would that be weird?
I think that's called stalking.
Maybe I won't do that.
Yeah,
well,
I would advise no.
Okay, in the last segment, we had on Angel Castillo. She's a candidate who is running to become mayor of Ogden City. Leah, this is all in the context of Utah's municipal elections, which are held in odd years, and it is 2023, so we're in a municipal election cycle.
Right.
The timeline for the municipal elections has been upended by the special election to fill the forthcoming vacancy by Representative Chris Stewart in the 2nd District.
That's right. So we all kind of have an understanding of what the new timeline is going to look like. But to be fair, and before we bring in our guest, Ricky Hatch, who's the Weber County Clerk and Auditor, I think it's not official until their special session next
That's
Wednesday.
That's right. We're relying on the governor's call, his proclamation for the special session. In that call, he outlined in great specificity what that special election could or should look like. We know that the legislature constitutionally is bound to only act on what is in that governor's call. So we have, a pretty good sense, but it's not official yet. That's a great point, Leah.
All right. So, Ricky, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
So, Ricky, tell us, I'm feeling like people from the lieutenant governor's office must be talking to you all about how things are changing or what's happening, or is it the case, is everyone kind of pausing until it's official next week?
It's a little both. They've been really good at reaching out to us. We had a good call yesterday with them, a comprehensive call. The lieutenant governor was on that, and they went over all the details. They let us vent a little bit of some of our frustrations, and then they said, okay, now it's time to get to work. And they provided a lot of good information.
Yeah. I remember working in the state elections office back in the day, and many Utahns may not know that our 29 county clerks are the ones who do all of the work.
That's right.
They administer our elections. They do it also for cities. The cities contract with them to run their elections. Essentially, the state gives county clerks a couple thousand pages of regulation and laws, and tells them exactly what they have to do and when they have to do it. And then county clerks are left to themselves to figure out how to do the hard work, and they do it, and they do it better than anyone else in the country. So, Ricky, I hear your frustration.
But tell us,
I empathize.
What is one of the frustrations, Ricky?
Can you give us
having
one of those specific points of frustration as a clerk?
Oh, I can give you just a couple of quick ones. One is, election officials often will preprint pre-print their envelopes to save money and to block them up. But you have dates on those envelopes. And so fortunately, most counties that I'm aware of did not pre-print this year. And so we were able to change those the look of the envelopes and the inserts in advance before they were actually printed. Also, we kind of want to have Thanksgiving, but that's probably not going to happen much this year. We might do takeout for Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
this
pause
year.
Right there because the general election, which I actually hadn't even thought of. Oh my goodness, Ricky, I'm so sorry, but like the ballots are all going to roll in on like a Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, and what I just heard you say is you and all your staff are going to be at work.
Ricky's not leaving the office.
That's right. We'll bring you turkey.
Okay, that's rough. One more. Give us strike three, Ricky. Give us one more issue.
Well, the staff, it's going to be hard, especially for the larger counties, to get enough staff to work because of the holiday issue. The primary election is actually the day after Labor Day, and so there's concerns on getting enough people willing to work that close to a holiday. And also, we might have to pay them holiday overtime pay. So there could be an additional cost there.
So I have a question right here, because I do feel like Taylor was saying earlier, 1,000 pages of code and regulations, and I'm thinking in my head, unfunded mandate, right? So what counties get told is, here's all the stuff you have to do. In the conversation, was money allocated to pay holiday pay for people?
They're actually collecting that information now. And really, the Lieutenant Governor's office and the legislature, I mean, it's not a horrible change. I mean, it's hard, but we'll work with it and deal with it the way we always do. But it's not a horrible change. We just have to complain just a little, and then we'll get to work. But they're putting together cost estimates.
You are entitled, I think, to complain a little bit here, Ricky, and certainly we appreciate the way you're working closely with the state elections office, with the legislature and the governor's office to make this work. No, nothing is more important than elections, right? Yeah. And having a secure, reliable, trustworthy process. Certainly, this is going to cost some taxpayer dollars. I know the governor and legislature are trying to align with the municipal cycles to reduce that
burden.
Yeah,
that was going to be my question. Like, literally, I'm thinking about what you're saying about these two holidays, Ricky, and I just didn't think about it till you said it. But everyone is saying the reason we want to align the elections is to save money. And I guess the question is the cost of, right, like paying all these people holiday pay, it would surely not offset the savings of aligning the elections, right, Ricky? So it's not going to be the case that we're actually going to come in net, you know, behind, right? There's not going to be a net loss as a result.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. I mean, if they were to pay for a full-on election, yeah, we're not even going to come close to that, okay. Even with some additional cost. So I think they were pretty wise in how they selected the dates. And, you know, it's a little bit of a pain, but it's, you know, we just get it done. It's okay.
Yeah. Now, Ricky, you don't have any of the second district in Weber County. Is that correct?
Thank heavens, no.
Right, because you don't have to worry about verifying candidate signatures, right? So congrats on that. That's a win for Weber County for sure.
Yes.
Do you?
We're happy about that.
Taylor's a big fan of signatures,
yes,
though, Ricky,
yes.
So be careful.
Ricky and I have had conversations about that in the past as well, and he's been very kind to me.
He's always
gracious.
Yes.
Ricky, I want to ask you, we had on in our previous segment Angel Castillo, who is a candidate running for mayor of Ogden City, and we speculated a little bit with her about whether or not we think this special election for the second district could maybe boost voter turnout in cities even outside of the second district. What's your reaction to that as a county clerk? And I'm not putting you on the record here with anything. We're speculating, so you're on the hot seat, but you're in a safe place.
Good. I do suspect that there's probably a little bit of fallout or coattails, something like that, because there will be a lot of news about the change in dates and about the congressional special election, and I think that'll just spill over a little bit. The one nice thing is, with us sending out ballots to all active registered voters, you know, in elections like this, the turnout does tend to be a little bit higher, actually quite a bit higher than it would if all voting were done in person. But, yeah, I think there will be a little bit of residual impact across the state just because of the increased media attention.
All right. So Ricky Hatch, Weber County Clerk, my county clerk, Taylor, just so you know.
And auditor. Don't forget
and
the auditor.
He's also the auditor.
He has two huge jobs.
Right. So I like the county clerk one better.
Okay, that's
we'll
fair.
Just go with that. So, Ricky, maybe you can't tell us, but can you share dates that you're expecting, right? Like when ballots will be coming out in Weber County, but maybe also across the state? When should people start paying attention?
You bet. Of course, everything is subject to the legislature next week, but right now with the and state law requires that ballots are sent out 21 days, no earlier than 21 days before election day. So the primary will be on September 5th.
We're all figuring this out in real time.
In my head, I'm like 21 days, somewhere August 10th or something, 15th. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so yeah, you're looking at mid to late August for the primary, and then right after Halloween, you'll start seeing your ballots in the mail
for the general November.
And KSL News Radio reporter Lindsay Ertz has been covering this today. Voters who are affiliated with a different party or unaffiliated, if they would like to vote in the Republican primary in this special election, they need to affiliate as a Republican as soon as possible. The legislature will probably be making some adjustments to that timeline, and there will be a cutoff point as to when voters are still able to affiliate. Ricky,
I've heard that as well, that there's some interest on the part of the legislature to restrict party swapping or party switching for the primary. I don't have any dates, but I'm sure that'll be part of their discussions.
Yeah.
All right, Ricky Hatch, Weber County Clerk and Auditor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. You guys are awesome.
Hey, I want to come back after the break, Taylor, and I want to chat with you about baseball.
Baseball?
Baseball.
Wow,
and
okay.
And all the politics maybe therein.
I can't wait. Stay tuned.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources, except you don't have Boyd Matheson today. You have me, Leah Murray, and my friend Taylor Morgan. Taylor, as always, it's a pleasure spending 2 hours chatting about the news of the day.
That flew by, Leah.
Right? It always does. But also today, my goodness.
Yeah, what a whirlwind.
What a day. Like our first hour was intense.
We kicked the show off in the very first segment by going live, breaking live to the press conference with the special counsel Jack Smith, essentially talking about the lengthy indictment that the DOJ just unsealed, indicting former President Donald J. Trump. Look, we still have a lot to talk about getting into those charges. It does appear to be fairly significant, consequential. I would say, Leah, it feels different and seems different than some of the other charges that Donald Trump is facing elsewhere. I'm not an attorney. I'm not an expert. I have read through the top lines of the indictment, but I haven't read every word.
Right.
But that's my reaction, right?
Right. So my reaction is I'd rather talk about something else at the end of our 2 hours, if that's okay with you.
I love it. It's the weekend. It's Friday
afternoon.
It's the weekend.
Let's move off of the national news and let's focus on the fact that a couple of months ago, a group in Salt Lake City announced it's pursuing bringing a Major League Baseball franchise to the state.
Big League Utah.
And I am so happy. Baseball is my favorite sport.
I know, Leah. I know this about you. I love it about you. The only problem I have.
There is no problem.
Leah.
Go.
The only problem I have is that you and I can talk about baseball. I spend 30% of my waking hours at kids' baseball games. I love baseball. But Leah, you're a Yankees fan.
I am a Yankees fan.
I don't want to talk about baseball with you.
Dude, I'm from. Why? Because we are the best?
I don't want. Exactly.
It must be hard.
Exactly. Yeah. So Leah, why are you a Yankees fan?
Because I grew up in New York.
Okay. That's
and my dad grew up in New York, and it's called family tradition and loyalty.
Okay.
And yeah.
So,
but if Utah gets a team,
that's exactly where
yep.
I was going, Leah, because with baseball, and maybe this is just me, but baseball is unique in sports in that there's this nostalgia. The geography of baseball to me is so compelling. And of course, the fact that you're from New York makes it excusable, I guess, that you're a Yankees fan. But if we get a team here in Utah, then Utahns won't have to look elsewhere for teams to follow. They will have their hometown team win or lose. They will cheer and be fans of that team.
Root for the home team, which will be here. So here's the deal. If we get a baseball team, they have to play somewhere. And I don't think there's a major league baseball park. And I am someone who just went to Fenway last week because I went to a Boston Red Sox game.
Humble brags here.
So I'm just going to say, yeah.
What did you wear your Yankees shirt to Fenway?
I did not because I was rooting for the home team.
You're a coward.
No,
because
I'm
you're not
polite.
A real Yankees fan then, I guess, huh?
No, well, if they were playing the Yankees, man, I would have had my Yankees gear. They
That's
were playing
fair.
The Reds, so no. And so Fenway's gorgeous. I have been to Denver Stadium, Yankees Stadium. I have been, right, like I just... It's not a collector of the stadiums, but anytime I'm somewhere and there's a baseball game, I'm going to watch the baseball game. So so this is the rub. This is the political question. If we have a baseball team, we need to have a baseball stadium that is a major league baseball level stadium, right?
Yes.
Like it's got a level up. So talk to me about what that looks like and who's paying for it.
Well, it's very expensive, Leah, is kind of the first thing. Salt Lake City, maybe to take a step back, Salt Lake City has historically been seen as an amazing venue for baseball. Dirks Field back in the day was widely acclaimed nationwide as having one of the best views and best backdrops, in all of baseball. We had major league teams coming here for exhibition games in the 60s and 70s.
Because it was just so pretty.
Because of the picturesque location of Dirks Field and what is now Smith's Ballpark. Salt Lake City is a beautiful backdrop. It is a beautiful place for a outdoor venue, a stadium like that. Not too long ago, several weeks ago, this group, Big League Utah, led by the Miller family, Gail Miller, they announced in partnership with Rocky Mountain Power that they were starting this new organization, this new effort to bring a Major League Baseball team to Salt Lake City. They released some sketches of what a stadium could look like, where it would be out here just on this corridor adjacent to I-80 and just west of downtown Salt Lake City, just south of, I believe, the State Fair Park area. Right now, it is not a great place because it has been a power industrial facility, but the plans look really exciting. It's a great place to put a ballpark, but Leah, it's not going to be cheap.
And who pays for it? So if the Miller family and the group that they are leading, do they come to the city and they say, give us this land and we will develop this? Or is it the case that people in Salt Lake City, or does it become a statewide venture, right, Taylor, where the whole state's got to put some taxpayer money behind it?
Yeah, it's a good question. The land where the proposed stadium would be is owned by Rocky Mountain Power, so it is already privately owned. And the presumption there is that they would donate or give that land essentially for the development of not only the ballpark, but surrounding businesses and residential areas.
So pause right there. The assumption is, or I mean, has anyone asked Rocky Mountain Power?
That was what was described at the press conference several weeks ago. I haven't read it in detail, so I'm speculating to be clear. But that's my understanding of it, Leah. The Miller family is stepping up, saying they're committed to funding the stadium. They didn't get into the details of what percentage or how much or project what it would cost. But I think it is safe to say, Leah, that to make this happen, it could very well involve some taxpayer dollars. I think we saw that with the Olympics here in Utah. Right?
Yeah.
We had massive infrastructure needs. We had to build venues. We expanded I-15 and other roads. It was incredibly expensive to host the Olympics, but Utah certainly benefited in numerous ways. We have infrastructure. We have tracks. We have Front Runner. We have a lot of assets that we still use today were paid for by tax dollars in order to host the Olympics.
Right. So let's just pause right here in the politics of this. So Deseret News Hinckley just ran a poll to see what people thought about it, Taylor, and 15% strongly support, 32% somewhat support. So that's like, 47%, right?
Yeah.
And then we've
got
50% on the opposition side.
Yeah.
So 20% somewhat opposed, 30% strongly opposed. So this doesn't seem like an easy sell.
Well,
right?
I would say that, look, it's within the margin of error. It's an even 50-50 at this point. And my guess is that if it's not a done deal, right? Utah is competing against other cities and venues for either a relocation
right,
or an
so
expansion
I've got a list.
Team.
It's like Portland, right. Nashville, Charlotte, Montreal are all also possible expansion
yeah,
sites.
Yeah. So it's not a done deal. It's not a sure thing, Leah. If we do get a Major League Baseball team in Salt Lake City, I feel pretty confident that a strong, vast majority of Utahns will be so thrilled and so excited by that that they will support the use of some taxpayer money to do it.
Is that? But do you think that has to be a result of – so maybe this 50-50 is we don't know yet.
It's too early.
It's too early. And no. Maybe the 50-50 is not everyone even thought about it. So, but you're saying, look, here's the deal. Once we're on the table and we are in the game, it's going to be easy to make that sell.
Yeah, it's not theoretical. It's not just a possibility. It's a real thing. Look, Utahns get very excited about their professional sports teams. We were very excited to host the Olympics. We are also in the running to host the Olympics again. If we actually get a Major League Baseball team here in Salt Lake City, I think Utahns will jump at that opportunity, and they'll be very supportive of a responsible and limited use of taxpayer money to do it.
All right. Taylor Morgan, it was fabulous spending 2 hours with you.
Yankees
listeners.
Suck, Leah. The Yankees suck.
They do not. They do not. Everyone else, come on back on Monday for more Inside Sources, and hopefully Boyd will be back with you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City.
Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM.
KSL News Radio,
Utah's all-day companion for news.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.